Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and we're in depth on what happens after incarceration. We wanted to come back to this issue after our January criminal justice series because it's something that our communities have a big stake in. Most people who go to prison are going to get out, and research tells us that they'll struggle to find jobs, locate a place to live, reconnect with their children and their families, and that can have consequences for all of us. Two guests today on the challenges of reentry and your thoughts, too. If you or someone in your family has faced some obstacles in finding a job or a place to live after being incarcerated, tell us a bit about what it was like. And if you advocate for people coming out of prison, what stands in the way of a successful reentry for many people? So if this is something that has been a deal, an issue in your circle of friends or in your family, I'd love to know about the obstacles that you faced in finding a place to live after being incarcerated. And if you advocate for people coming out of prison, what stands in the way of a successful reentry for a lot of people? Here's a phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Chris Eugen, is a professor of sociology and law at the University of Minnesota and a fellow of the American Society of Criminology, and he's with me in the studio. And Chris, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie. I love it.
Shaka Sengor is with us. He's the author of Righting My Wrongs and the senior fellow at Dream Corps, and he's with us today from Lansing, Michigan. And Shaka, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Shaka, I wondered if you'd tell us a little bit about your background. I know that you spent some amount of years in prison. What were you convicted for, and how long did you serve?
So I was convicted at the age of 19 of second-degree murder. I was sentenced to 17 to 40 years in prison, served a total of 19 years, seven of that in solitary confinement.
And how long have you been out?
I've been out now going on 7 years. In June, it'll be my seventh year home.
Tell me what happened when you came out to try to find a job.
When I came out, it was shocking to see how resistant society was to giving people like me second chances. And so I struggled to find employment, and I actually ended up having to start my own business in order to just provide for myself and my family. And so out of the 7 years that I've been free, I haven't had an official regular job, so to speak. I've had a lot of contractual jobs and a lot of collaborative work that I've been able to do just through my efforts as a entrepreneur and as a writer.
Do you think this is about, for potential employers, do you think this is, you went to prison for a violent crime and we don't know if we can trust you to be in our place of work? Or is it just, it's the general idea that you are out of the workforce for a very long time? What do you think it is?
Well, I think it's just a general ignorance associated with people who were formerly incarcerated. It doesn't make a difference what crime a person was convicted of. Just the fact that you have a felony as asked on that, you know, on applications is enough to have you discriminated against. I've worked with people who have nonviolent crimes who can't find employment because they have felonies on their record. And so, you know, when we think about mass incarceration and think about, you know, the millions of men and women who can't get a job because they have a felony on their record, who may not even have been incarcerated but just convicted of a felony, you know, we have to really talk to the larger issues of fear that has been the dominant energy in this space when it comes to incarceration, when it comes to punishment. And unfortunately, once people are sentenced, that sentence never ends even when they step outside of prison.
Chris, what do you think it is for employees? I hear Shaka on this, but do you also think, he mentioned the word ignorance. Do you think it's employers who believe that no matter what you serve time for and how much time you serve, you are still essentially that same person that ended up going into prison?
That's right. I mean, it's the convergence of two trends, really. I mean, the numbers of people who are subject to felony convictions now are at an all-time high. So there's about 20 million Americans. 15 million have a felony in their past, about 5 million currently. And we know employers really attend to those records. And so one of those trends is rising numbers. The other trend, though, is just digital punishment. And that is that it's so much easier to find out our records about one another, that it's quick and easy. You don't have to go to the courthouse. You don't have to file any special paperwork. And so it's all widely known. And we know that that employers discriminate. Even in the Twin Cities, our study, it was a three-year-old disorderly conduct arrest with no conviction.
Wow.
And still, employers took account of that in making the hire.
I wanted to put a little context around this. I'm sure you know about this Urban Institute study where more than 70% of people who were incarcerated reported that the record was affecting their job search. 31% were working in the months after being released. That's a lot of people who are out of work, who have come out of prison probably with not a lot of resources. What are they to do?
That's right. Well, it, as Shaka mentioned, you know, many are entrepreneurial. Not only do they have this discrimination that might be informal, but in some cases they're locked out of whole categories of jobs, particularly in the health sector, where there is a lot of job growth. And so people do start their own businesses. They do put things together here and there. And you know, some try to invest in their education, but there too, there is a box on 70% of college application forms now asking about criminal records.
Meaning that universities may not accept you if you have a criminal record?
That's right, particularly for those convicted of any kind of violent offense, even if it isn't in the far distant past. And so it becomes very difficult to escape these records.
Call here from Yvette in Minneapolis. Hi, Yvette. This sounds like this is something that's happened within your family.
Absolutely, on multiple occasions. I have brothers who have served time, and despite some of their efforts to rejoin the workforce, they've been discriminated against, and they come up against barriers like employee abuse, where the employee refuses to pay them or underpays them or strings them along for weeks with promises to pay them and threaten them. So who are you going to report to? And they seem helpless. They cannot advocate for themselves, because if they lose that poor job, then they are even poorer because they're now unemployed. And I think they even, you know, that circle gets small. And so other employers don't employ problem ex-offenders, if you will. So it's a circle of poverty that is impacting, again, a lot of brown people.
Mm-hmm. Shaka, thanks so much, Yvette, for the call, because this is something that I wanted to ask Shaka about. Do you find that even among some of the people that you've been working with, that even when somebody gets a job, they don't really feel like they can exercise all the full rights that any other employee would, that they're in these kind of positions that Yvette described?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very vulnerable space to be in, because even when people tend to hire you, there's prejudice that comes with your past that you just can't seem to escape. And so there's always this fear of, you know, losing your job if somebody who works there finds out, and just say there's a conflict between, you know, other, you know, with other employees, that it can be taken out of context, or it can be seen as something other than what it is, which can just be a, you know, job spat, which happens, you know, in any environment
right.
where you have a bunch of people working.
Right.
And just the right to raise your voice when things aren't being done, you know, the way that they should. I mean, in my experience, what I found is that people tend to take advantage of the fact that you're in desperate need of employment, and so they may not even pay you or offer you the same benefits that they offer other employees, because it's kind of like, you know, you're lucky you have a job, and, you know, there's just no way for an adult to live, and it's definitely not mentally or emotionally healthy for somebody trying to reacclimate themselves to society.
This is a conversation, if you've just joined us, with Shaka Sengor and Chris Eugen, as we talk about the challenges of re-entering the job market, of a family life, of trying to find somewhere to live after you've spent some time in prison. And when we hear about these numbers, the number of people that are doing time, by the way, for nonviolent offenses, for drug offenses, this is a big deal for our communities. We should care about what happens when people come out of some kind of incarceration and are struggling to find productive work and a place to live. Chris Eugen with us from the U of M, Shaka Sengor with us. As someone who has spent some time in prison, who has dealt with some of the things, who has written about this, and who started a business, he's the author of Righting My Wrongs. Chris, on Twitter here, a listener says, please discuss how low-level sex offenders and the difficulties they also face in finding employment, also some just for sexting.
Right. The sex offender is a category that we call hyper-stigma.
Uh-huh.
This is far more stigmatizing in many settings, particularly higher education and employment. Even when we asked about whether people with felony convictions should be able to vote, people thought, well, sex offenders had the lowest support among all of offense categories we asked about. So there is a stigma, and I think there is an assumption that that each sex offender is somebody who has victimized a child, or that it doesn't take in the full range of criminal sexual conduct, which can cover a real gamut from grabbing someone in a bar all the way to that very serious crime. And so it's clear that in the employment setting and in other settings, there's very limited options. But there, I would say also, I mean, you mentioned housing, mm-hmm. and housing yeah. for people with sex crimes is particularly difficult. And on this one, there's also kind of a lay assumption that once a sex offender, always a sex offender, and so the registries are permanent.
Know why that is. I mean, because some of the crimes that have been committed by former sex offenders are horrific and get a lot of attention. And I know that's probably the small subset
that's correct.
Of what happens, but that's where the media goes.
Yeah, and I think one myth, though, is that there's an exceptionally high recidivism rate among sex offenders, which is not the case, although there is some, they do tend to offend a bit later in life course than other, than say, garden variety, burglars, robbery, et cetera. But there is not this 100% recidivism rate or something among sex offenders that I think is built in, is assumed in many of the models.
Do you oppose a registry for the reasons that we've just been talking about?
I would narrow the registry considerably. And so I do think it's in part because when we impose this kind of, as I said, hyper-stigma, that is something that is permanent and long-lasting, we need to be very careful with how broadly we extend that. I would say it's overly broad today.
So I'm asking to hear from you as you hear how our discussion is developing. If this is an issue in your family or in your circle of friends, maybe someone in your family has faced some obstacles in finding a job or a place to live after having been incarcerated. Tell us a bit about what that has been like. And if you advocate for people who are coming out of prison, what stands in the way? And I think we're hearing some of the reasons here of a successful reentry into the job market and into our society. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter. At Carrie NPR, Craig says not hiring felons will continue to cause a negative feedback loop for our society. We have to break this cycle. And Joshua says, I think easier felony expungements are needed, but ultimately people made bad decisions and they need to be held accountable. Shaka, I wonder what you make of that last tweet.
About people having to be held accountable?
Well, he's saying easier felony expungements may be needed here, but the last part of this was ultimately people made bad decisions and they need to be held accountable.
Well, my reaction to that is when a person serves their sentence, they have been held accountable, and that sentence should not extend once they're released from prison. And that's the thing about, you know, society that we live in, where we want to continue to punish people even though they've served a sentence. Even when we get down to the idea of nonviolent versus violent offenders, the reality is whatever your offense was, if you've served your sentence, when you get back to society, you shouldn't be held hostage based on your past. And it doesn't matter whether you were formerly convicted of a violent crime or not. If you're not committing crimes when you get out and you just want to work and you want to live freely, you want to get an apartment or a house like any other person who is, in society. We're very hypocritical about what rights to extend to people who have served their time. And so, you know, it's society's responsibility to stop punishing people far beyond the sentences they've served. You know, I've been out of prison for 7 years. I was convicted of something 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not the same person, you know, 25 years now. And the fact that I've accomplished more than most people have in the last 7 years than most people have accomplished in their life. And it's a testament to the fact that, you know, people can change. They can turn their lives around. They can create opportunities, and they can take advantage of opportunities when extended to them. But it starts with us really removing those stigmas, those labels. I mean, we live in a society where we're so used to othering people, you know, whether it's poverty, whether it's, you know, sex, whether it's gender, whatever the case is, we're always finding ways to isolate people and box people in by these very, you know, arbitrarily imposed ideas of what people are as opposed to what's something that people have done. And we need to differentiate the two.
A call here from Dan in southern Minnesota. Hi, Dan. This sounds like it has affected you personally. Is that right?
That's correct, Carrie. And thanks so much for the discussion. I was released from prison in February of 2011. Mm-hmm. I'm 13 years sober. I was an active addict when I was arrested, and it was the right decision for the courts to make. I was the dean of a small college, and with all the academic credentials that come with that,
wow.
When I was released in 2011, I worked very hard to try to work with organizations that do transition work, organizations like 180 Degrees or RS Eden, which are, I mean, do fantastic work in the Twin Cities. But the Department of Human Services in the state of Minnesota permanently bars people with my level of felony conviction from working with vulnerable populations. So I could not work with the people that I would have been an absolute asset for. I ended up getting a menial part-time job, and that turned into a menial full-time job. And I met somebody who gave me a professional job, and I now run a small nonprofit in South Dakota. I have a great job, and I have a great life, but it took 5-6 years to get to where I am, and I don't have the barriers that a lot of other people getting out of prison have. I have a supportive family. I have a supportive network of friends, and I have a really good professional resume and excellent skills. People coming out without job training or people coming out without their basic education are at significant disadvantages.
Well, I hear that loud and clear. Chris, it looks like you have a question for Dan or a thought there.
Well, I was really thinking, too, about the lost productive capacity for the state and our citizens. I mean, one of the things, you know, you can frame this as kind of a bleeding heart issue or something, but really in an aging Minnesota, we need more prime age workers, and frankly, we need more taxpayers. And so pushing people out imposes a cost not just on those we're pushing out, but on the rest of us as well.
Dan, I'm really glad you heard the show and had a chance to call in. Thank you. Stephanie on Twitter says, a quote summarized from our former governor, Al Quie. He said, our country's greatest potential is in our prisons. To the phones to Mufi in St. Louis Park. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. I've been listening to your show. It's been very interesting.
Okay.
I agree with the professor and Shaka about a lot of things, but myself, I was released from prison in 2000, mm-hmm. after serving about 11 years, and even here in 2017, I'm having problems finding housing. I'm having problems getting, I guess, startup money to even start my own business, but by the grace of God, and I really emphasize that, by the grace of God, I'm still out here. Because if you're impoverished a little bit, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The only reason I'm out here is because I'm a mechanic by trade. That's one of the first things I did when I got out of prison. I went and got a AAS in automotive training. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I did. While I was in prison, I got a couple of degrees in computers, thinking that when I got out, I'll be able to get into the job force, get back out there, and just do my thing. What I found out was I was getting out acing tests. I was acing these tests for people that were just walking around outside. I was getting out of prison acing tests, and I couldn't get the job.
Mufi, do you think that was because the minute they saw that you had to disclose, that you'd been in prison? Hey, here's the other thing I'm curious about. I'm wondering if, you know, this is tied to recidivism, right? You can't find a good job. You can't find proper housing. It becomes all the easier to slip back into behavior.
Absolutely. It's like they try to put you in a box. They're trying to put you in a box to keep you in the penal system where they're creating all these jobs where they pay you 40 cents a day, but you're making office furniture that sells for thousands. You see what I'm saying? It's like a recycled thing. And if a person isn't aware and conscious of what's really going on, they'll find themselves in a never-ending loop, going back into prison, doing their labor, going back to prison, doing their labor, creating this big, big boom in this money that people are making. That's why I really think. I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of crazy person or a person with a conspiracy theorist, but I think there's a diabolical plan behind all of this. And I'm just going to leave with that, all right? I'm not a crazy person. Trust me, I'm not a crazy person.
No, I really appreciate your observations here, Mufi, and I'm glad you heard the show. Shaka, would you speak to that, the difficulty that then you slip back into the behavior that may have sent you to prison in the first place?
Well, I mean, I get an opportunity to work with amazing men and women all over the country who were formerly incarcerated who are trying to help other men and women enter the job force. And we all have similar stories of the phone calls we get daily about, you know, people who are feeling desperate to provide for their families, and they feel like they have no other alternative but to return to, you know, street hustles or the black market, if you will, in order to provide for their families. And it's a very difficult place to be in. And I remember feeling that level of vulnerability after I went in and I had a great interview and was told that they were really interested in hiring me, and then only to find out later that they wouldn't hire me because of my felony and how devastated I was. You know, I had a young child at the time, Mm-hmm. My son was like, you know, maybe 10 months old, and, you know, being an entrepreneur, we know it takes time to actually turn profits. And I felt the desperation that other people feel. And, you know, fortunately, I made a commitment to never go back to that lifestyle. But I'm never shocked when people choose to go back to their lifestyle. I mean, we have a 70% recidivism rate nationally when it comes to men and women going back to prison.
That's extraordinary.
And it starts because people get boxed out of the workforce and don't have an opportunity to provide for themselves. So they do what they feel like they have to do in order to take care of their families. And it's just a really sad space to be in when you really want to do the right thing and no one's willing to give you an opportunity.
Chris, I think this article that I was reading in the New York Times a couple weeks ago goes to this, too. It was talking about the fact that there is not a lot of research on the reorientation of people that come out of prison and the emotional and psychological toll that takes. And let me just read a quick couple of sentences here, because I'm sure you're familiar with this. The story said, often the psychological turbulence of those first few days or weeks is so debilitating that recently incarcerated people can't navigate public transportation. They're too frightened of crowds. I mean, it really gave us a sense of this is a whole new world that gets thrust on you. And that's confusing on top of having to settle the job and that place to live and all of that. Could you speak to that?
That's right. I mean, it's a big switch and a big adjustment. And one of the ways we know that is we've got a study comparing people leaving prison with people leaving the military, leaving combat,
right,
leaving drug treatment, leaving other institutions. And those who leave prison, the difference, everybody has a shock. And part of it is the astounding array of choices that you have to make every day on the outside that may be made for you on the inside. But the difference is that we have social supports and opportunities to broaden the networks of people, say, who are in military combat. They have the VA, they have the GI Bill, and various other social supports. For prisoners, they don't have much of that. It's a rather thin. We have heroic people doing amazing work in organizations locally and nationally, but it's a real uphill battle. And that label that we talked about, that's just gotten stickier and stickier with increased electronic access to anybody's criminal record anytime.
Shaka, I know you have to run. I'm really grateful for the time this morning. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Shaka Sengor is the author of Righting My Wrongs, and he's a senior fellow at Dream Corps. Our conversation continues with Chris Eugen. He's a professor of sociology and law at the U of M. And asking you this morning, if you've just gotten in on the tail end of the discussion, as we talk about reentry after time in prison or in incarceration, if someone in your family has faced this, what are the greatest obstacles? I'll try to get in as many calls as I can in the time we have left. And then if you advocate for people who are in this situation, I'd like to hear about your experience with that as well. To the phones here to Chris in Duluth. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this show and giving visibility and to this. It's a super important issue. I'm somebody who is on the predatory offender list due to really hurtful choices I made in my past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've served my time. I'm fully accountable. I pled guilty immediately. I'm not in denial of the causes of my my hurtful choices, and I'm living rightfully now, trying to take care of my family as best I can, and just deadwalled in trying to find gainful employment. I have really marketable information technology, education, healthcare skills, and have even been into interviews where everything just sung. And then I opted for transparency during the interview, presented some letters from the professionals I work with who helped me in treatment, probation, who are awesome in the work that they do. And, the next morning you get the email, I just really want to actually make a very specific, request and advocate for revisiting the predatory offender list and creating some path for people to get off of that. I think that there is efficacy in having that kind of mechanism to monitor people. There are people, in my experience, who need to have that level of monitoring. And then there are people who have really worked hard to understand themselves, make changes in their lives, and need to have some mechanism to get off of that.
Chris, stay on for just a second here, and let me go to Chris Eugen, who does a lot of research on this. When Chris, our caller, says that he then, decides to be transparent in these interviews, do you have any advice at all, Chris, about how to disclose something like this without blowing up, what looks like it might be leading to a job?
Well, I think the advice that many give these days is to be transparent, simply because the record will follow you. Getting those letters is important, but also having a personal network and somebody who knows the hiring authority makes a huge difference. Now, when you apply for a job, that didn't work out for Chris in this instance, but making contact with the hiring authority, that manager, looking them in the eye, and then they can see that you're not a faceless evil person, but you're a human being in that room who's accountable for their actions.
Right, who says exactly what Chris just said.
Exactly.
I took responsibility for that, and it was years
Chris,
ago.
That's really wonderful, and that's where my gut is, but I've actually gotten an exact opposite advice. Don't say anything. Get the job. Then if they do the background check, then you're can be actionable. And that goes against everything that I am, have become through the process of this awful at great cost to many people, and I also have brought to the table really well-placed references, mayors and state legislators who I know and who know me now. And it just, I think it's in, there's a, it's a, it's at the HR level that needs to be addressed. My dream would be to go speak at an HR conference.
is he right, Chris, about the HR side of this?
Well, yeah. And in Minnesota since 2014, we've had Ban the Box.
Right.
And so we've removed it, but it has sort of pushed the discrimination down the line. And so now if you're
so they don't find out then, but they find out later. And you were going to say, I'm sorry.
No. Yeah. And I think that's, I certainly understand the Chris's experiences and points on this. As I said, it's partly due to the assumptions people have. If I could change one thing in our law, it would be to make some of these time limited, so that is, we know that as criminologists that after 7 years, the likelihood that somebody released will commit a new crime if they haven't is approximately the same as the general population. So there's no real value in continuing punishment and stigmatization after that point. But I don't think that's widely known.
I didn't know that. I wonder if that's ever discussed at the state legislative level. Yes.
Yes. I think there's more talk of sunsetting some of these provisions. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is it's a bipartisan movement. This is people on the right, people on the left.
That is heartening, isn't it?
It
around
is.
Some of this criminal justice reform. Finally.
That's right. And I think we're in a moment where the economy is good. There is an opportunity for people. It wasn't in the late 90s. We were getting job fairs for probationers and parolees because their labor was so needed. Now, I think we need to do more in prison education as well to get people ready to take those jobs that are out there. But it is a favorable moment right now.
Sharon on Twitter says, and this is about her son. My son had 3 job offers rescinded when his background came back, despite the fact that he disclosed this during the interviews. And then she adds, with every job offer, he holds his breath, hoping not to be rejected again. She says, I admire his focus and resiliency. Just in the minute we have left, Chris, you just noted that these are bipartisan efforts to do some of this reform around criminal justice. What do you think has prompted that? Just... numbers, the awareness.
Yeah, and I think the irrationality of continuing punishment for so long. And as I said, there's a social cost. There's a cost to all of us as taxpayers, as citizens, by keeping people out. It's not just because we want to be nice. It's because we need every Minnesotan working together.
This is why I was saying at the top of the show that this is a deal for communities, right? Not just families who are involved in this.
That's right.
A stake.
20 million people.
Chris, thank you so much. Really good to have you here.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to find our criminal justice series, we did a series of shows on Tuesdays in January. You can find that in my podcast. Just go search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcast, all ready and waiting for you when you're ready.